I'm reading a column by David Brooks, who writes for the New York Times. And he was saying that the global pandemic of 100 years ago, 1918, that period, that people didn't talk about it because they were ashamed that his argument is that they were ashamed that they didn't come to the enough aid of people in their social network. I think there are probably other reasons as well. But I think people will talk about this for a very, very long time. I think our cultural memory, global cultural memory, will keep this as an event. We talk a lot about 9/11 as being a watershed event in the United States. Of course, this is even larger than that because it's global. And I think that this will be in our collective cultural memory for many years to come. And I think I'd like to think that we're going to learn from it and make the most of the experiences that we maybe took for granted.
The great philosopher Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." Looking back only results in learning for people who have that time to think, and many of us are so busy with day-to-day demands that we rarely have time to reflect. And that's why we started What I Wish I Knew. It's for those moments when you realize that just a bit of insight might have come in handy if you had it in advance. I'm Mike Irwin.
And I'm Simon Dorr. So we talk with people from all walks of life, from startup entrepreneurs to Fortune 500 CEOs, professional athletes to weekend warriors, from artists and to designers to even engineers who became designers, from those who dream to those who dream, then actually do. They all have three things in common. None are perfect, all are humble, and each have truly incredible learnings. In What I Wish I Knew, they share these lessons with you.
Well, welcome to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw. We're delighted today to have Bob Morais with us, who is a business anthropologist with experience in advertising and market research. And Bob began his career on Madison Avenue with Gray Advertising and spent 25 years in the advertising industry, rising to the level of chief strategic officer at an agency where he was advising some of the biggest brands in the world. And then he moved on from advertising and went into market research, where he was principal at Weinman Schnee Marais, a market research firm. But he's worked with the likes of Procter & Gamble and Coca-Cola, GlaxoSmithKline, Johnson & Johnson, Post Foods, Danone, Hain Celestial, Fairmont, and Swiss Hotel, among others. He's the author of 5 books and more than 50 articles, many of which Simon and I have read over time. His work has appeared in the likes of the Huffington Post and Advertising Age, Forbes, American Anthropologist. He's been interviewed by the New York Times, CBS Radio, and Adweek, among others. So Simon and I are delighted that you're willing to join us for this. And he holds a PhD from the University of Pittsburgh. Aside from that, in his spare time these days, he's also a lecturer at the Columbia Business School. So Bob, welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Bob, tell us how you got here.
Well, I've had an unusual career. I think people that define themselves as business anthropologists often have, because especially those of us of a certain vintage. I started out in academic anthropology. My doctoral research was in the rural Philippines, and I thought I'd be an academic. My focus was cultural anthropology. And for those of you not familiar with anthropology, it traditionally consists of 4 fields. There's cultural anthropology, that's the kind that Margaret Mead did, if you know who she is or was. There is archaeology, which is the Indiana Jones type. And then there's physical anthropology. Sometimes people look at it as evolutionary anthropology. It really looks at how human beings evolved over time. And then there's anthropological linguistics. And there's a little overlap sometimes. And then there's an area of anthropology called applied anthropology, which takes any one of those disciplines and applies it to real world problems. So anyway, I was a cultural anthropologist. And then I decided, for lots of reasons, including a job market that would have caused me to bounce around for a while, that I would learn something about American business. I took a course, actually it was a series of courses at NYU's New York University's Business School. That was back in the very beginning of 1980, moved from there into advertising, stayed in advertising for 25 years, started out in account management, then moved into account planning, which was really more the strategy and research side of the business. And so that was really my love. And then I, from there, as you said, I was invited actually by the two principals of Weinman Schnee to join the company as the third partner. And I did that was a partner and principal for 11 years. And along the way, I started doing some teaching at Columbia Business School. I've also done some academic writing. So I'm really defined as a business anthropologist, but along the way, I've been an advertising person. I've been a strategist, a business strategist. I've been a market researcher, a teacher. So it's perhaps a bit of an unusual process.
What I would like to say, Bob, is that you are the kind of person, well, and you specifically, but you are in general also the kind of people that people like Simon and I talk to when we really want to understand things. But first, a little bit of definition. Can you kind of, you know, share with our audience about what does anthropology really mean and how does it apply to business?
It is a question that people that are in business anthropology get quite a bit. Because people misunderstand what anthropologists do. They think of it as studying the cultural anthropology part of it, which is my specialty, as studying exotic, faraway people. And anthropologists certainly do that to some degree, but we also study ourselves, as in our own culture. Broadly, anthropology is defined as the study of human beings throughout time and throughout geography. So it's a very broad field. But cultural anthropology specifically studies everything from human customs to human rules for engagement with one another. So that would be in the customary rituals, institutions, all kinds of processes. When we get into looking at how anthropologists study business, there are a couple of areas that we really focus on. One of them is the market and marketing research area. Another one is organizational culture. Another is design, which is really emerging as a major field, and user experience. User experience and design are actually employing a lot of cultural anthropologists these days.
So, you know, I want to kind of get broad, and then we'll kind of get more specific into, you know, life and career of, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, in terms of anthropology, you know, in culture in particular, so, you know, is culture a static thing or is it evolving? And if it is evolving, why do sometimes we, you know, feel sort of this crashing of culture or beliefs that, you know, where there's resistance and push and that kind of thing? How would you describe that?
Well, actually, you just put your finger on it because the resistance has a lot to do with change. Culture is always changing. You know, people often think when I mention those exotic, faraway cultures, those people, their cultures have changed. Human culture has changed throughout time in myriad ways. And if you think of culture as, I mentioned, rules of engagement, culture is that. It's values and beliefs. It's how we make sense of things, how things become meaningful to us. But it also involves trends and currents. So there are changes happening all the time. We can see it in our lifetimes. We can see it across time. We know that the culture in the United States is not one culture, it's many cultures, and also cultures throughout time have changed. The culture in the United States for what we think of as mainstream American culture, if there ever was such a thing, has not remained the same. And that's part of where that tension is.
So Simon, let me just ask this one question, then you go. But I want to talk about that point because, you know, is culture really wrapped up in mythology? Is there an overlap there of this belief of what a country or a business or whatever, this collection of beliefs that may or may not necessarily be true?
Well, you know, the way anthropologists think of mythology, this is what I learned, I remember when I took a seminar on it back in graduate school, is that myths are stories that people believe to be true. And they achieve a kind of higher level, higher status level, a greater emotional attachment, greater meaning in terms of how we conduct our lives, because they lay out models for behavior for us. They tell stories of heroes. They tell stories of journeys. They tell stories of how cultures have dealt with change over time. So there's certainly that. And I think that we have ideas You know, America has myths about itself, stories that we believe to be true. And whether or not they are true or partially true is one of the things that's contested very often.
Well, just on the piece, and I kind of got a fix there of anthropology in the business environment, which I guess generally a lot of people listening here will be interested in. And you compartmentalize that about the people and the culture. You talked about marketing. And then finally, you talked about product and design. Can you just share a little bit of the insight and about each of those? And I'm keenly interested as somebody who's not as deep into it as you are clearly, but what are the things we should know about, you know, in our businesses about your, you know, your knowledge and skill set here in terms of how we should think about our businesses, both in terms of anthropology of people. Secondly, and I've compartmentalized this, of how we look at the marketing piece, and I guess talk about how we, you know, how we maximize our brand. And then thirdly, this product design, which sounds like it's a new area.
Well, so I'll start with marketing. A lot of people in business anthropology will tell you that the major tool that they use from a methodological standpoint is ethnography. So ethnography is really about, in not just business, but in any aspect of cultural anthropology, being there, watching people, talking to people, where they work, where they play, where they use brands, where they shop. And that's a great value to businesses, especially marketers, because they can watch people shopping in a supermarket. They can see how people use products in their lives in context. So we like to think as anthropologists holistically. So in other words, a 360 view of how a product or a brand will fit into people's lives, how they'll use it. But also what ethnography enables us to do is tap into what people may be doing, but they are not even so much aware of that they're doing it or thinking, or maybe they have problems that they don't even know are problems. So I'll give you an example that I love that Procter & Gamble did. I was not involved in this study, and they didn't even define it as an anthropological study, but they did ethnography. And it worked like this. They were developing Febreze. It wasn't doing that well. There was really nothing fundamentally wrong with the product. There are a couple of things that they wanted to do to improve it. And they did a study that was multifaceted. And there were a number of aspects to the study, including the ritual of cleaning, which I'm not going to get into. I'm going to talk about the part of it that I like the most, which really illustrates the value of what firsthand observation in a person's life, how that can really make a difference. So a research team went to a team, this was a Procter & Gamble research team, went to a woman's home, and she had 7 cats. Now remember, they're talking about Febreze. And you know, Febreze is a product that freshens fabrics of all kinds, chairs and so on. It's been a line extended now, but in those days it was really more about spraying it on a chair, spraying it on a couch. And so they're in this house and they're exploring this woman's life and how she might be using or not using the product. And she doesn't say anything about the house having the scent of 7 cats. Not a word. The researchers leave the house and basically conclude that she has a problem that other people visiting her house would recognize, but she wouldn't, because she's become accustomed to the scent of those cats. So she has something called nose blindness, which is actually a real thing. It's been studied. I remember looking it up early on, and it was a Penn State, I think, at least at the time, had a group that was really focusing on nose blindness, and we were all aware of it. Smells that we get so used to, we don't even notice they're bad. We don't even think about them anymore. We don't notice them. And so what Febreze realized is, and Procter & Gamble realized, is that they had to essentially inform people that other people would see something, sense something in their homes that they wouldn't otherwise notice. And so they created advertising. You may have seen it. Sometimes it still airs, it seems to me. I've seen it as recently as last year. They have a giant cat in a woman's home to illustrate the terrible smell that's being emitted by her pet cats that she doesn't even realize is there. But visitors to her home would realize and would judge her as maybe not having a clean house because the smell of a home often signals how clean it is, at least to many people. But the reason I love this study as an illustration of ethnography is because there is no way that Procter & Gamble would have found this out in a focus group, even in an in-depth interview, if you were in a, you know, wherever you might be in a facility, in a research facility. You wouldn't have found it out in a survey because people don't even know they have the problem. So that's just one example of ethnography. Now, there are other studies that anthropologists do. There's a journal called the Journal of Business Anthropology where a number of us have published, but we also publish in a lot of other places, and we talk about different examples of studies that we've done where we've been able to, either through ethnography or through other ways, maybe thinking about theories involving ritual that might help, or looking at kinship within families, or looking at how people's identities reflect their culture and how beauty might be seen in a given culture and how that might affect relationships, and then how a company like Revlon could market their products based on insights gained from a study like that. So we've gone, you know, I've done studies on industrial lubricants involving ethnography. I've done studies on dog and cat food, on hotels, many different types of studies that, and colleagues of mine have done the same, that use our ideas to fuel everything from new product development to market positioning, to even to specific advertising ideas. So, and it's really made a difference for a lot of companies.
You know, and kind of along those lines, I mean, we sit at a time, Bob, where everything, you know, almost everything is eminently measurable. And kind of modern marketers would say that, you know, there's reams of data that are generated largely online by, you know, by traffic and clicks and purchases and the whole thing. And that's, you know, that sort of data-driven or analytics are a key part of driving marketing now. But what I hear you saying is that's only part of the puzzle, which is, in truly gaining insight, it's not enough just to measure traffic or measure what people actually did, which they can get through those forms, but also measure or understand what they didn't do or what they considered.
And why? There's a sociologist, actually. Anthropologists sometimes hang out with sociologists. We like them just fine. And she likes to use the term thick data as opposed to big data. So big data is extremely valuable. We wouldn't dismiss that. A lot of anthropologists have a good understanding of quantitative. And my market research company used a lot of quantitative in our work. Courses that I teach, particularly one course, is an integration of qualitative and quantitative market research and why they need to complement one another. But what anthropologists do, and Mike, to your point, is that you can get a lot of information online. You can get extremely valuable information from surveys, from text mining, from consumer responses, and so on. That's all extremely important, and marketers use it all the time and should. But what an anthropologist can do is take, I hate to use this phrase, it's a little bit shopworn now, but take a deeper dive. What's even better is thickening the data, getting a richer sense of what's really going on so you understand why certain purchases are made. It's not enough to know that people are repeat buyers or that they might recommend this product or experience to a friend. I think it's more important to understand the deeper why, because then you can not only figure out more of what's going on that could inform your communications, but you can also improve your product. You can find out, you know, what I like to think of, not only pain points, but what I've started to call joy points. You know, what really bothers them about an experience, what they really love about an experience, and then address those. So obviously you're going to really leverage in a positive way those joy points and the pain points you need to address. Well, what anthropologists can do, and this isn't only in marketing, this can be an organizational culture, and it certainly applies to design and user experience. And Simon, this is to your point about design and user experiences, that we can be there in an environment. It could be face-to-face, it can be virtual. Most of our work, I would say, is ethnographic in some way. And during the pandemic, it's been virtual, but still it's been involving people in their natural environments. And we can understand more of what's really happening, what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what they might not otherwise express.
And Bob, on that note, I don't want to be dismissive of anthropology as a profession, but I wonder if there's a way that we could make everyday anthropologists. Everybody becomes one. And the reason I say that is that I think a lot of us go through life and we learn about some things or we continue to learn about some things, but we fail to learn about most of what we face every day because it's routine. And so while we are present, we're not observant.
Right.
And what I hear you saying in a lot of ways is if we apply those anthropology skills to everyday life, to our relationships, to our organizations, to our businesses, to our careers, it kind of might open a door to being observant and understanding the subtle signs that we otherwise ignore. Is that accurate?
I think it is accurate. I think it'll get you part of the way there, but not all the way there. And here's the way that I think about it. When I was talking about the Fabrice study, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up, I don't think any of those people were trained anthropologists, at least based on what I've read, they weren't. But they were going to people's homes and they were practicing a kind of ethnography. And that's really important. So observation is going to be valuable. And I would recommend every marketing manager, every student of organizational culture, anyone who's working on design or UX, they should be doing some form of ethnography. And they should at least know enough how to do it by, if they don't take a full course, reading about it, and they can get better at it. And they'll learn. And that's for sure. And a lot of people in design, and certainly in user experience, use ethnography all the time, whether or not they're formally trained. But there's another side to it. So that starts to get you where you want to be. But another level is adding the theory, a body of theory from anthropology that you really need some kind of formal training to have in your toolkit. So for example, a number of years ago, I was working with Post Foods and we were looking at breakfast and in the cereal business. And I'm trying to understand what breakfast is all about for people. And so it'd be one thing to observe people eating breakfast and see what's going on. But another way of thinking about it is to look at breakfast as a kind of rite of passage so that you separate yourself from your sleep state and then you enter another phase, kind of a middle phase, what anthropologists would call a liminal phase, where you're having breakfast and you're enjoying the process of making the coffee and the scent of the coffee. Maybe you're having coffee, maybe not. But you're also preparing the cereal. You're having that sensitive, the senses of the taste of the cereal, the crunch of the cereal, maybe the sound of the cereal. All of that's happening. And it could be transforming you in that kind of middle eating period before you get to the last period, which is beginning your day. So think of it as three phases. So there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. Or an anthropologist would think of it as these rites of passage where you're separating yourself from your sleep state. You're having this middle phase of kind of transformation or transition. And then you're integrating yourself into your daily life, in a sense, reintegrating yourself into the life that you lived the day before or something similar to it. But by looking very closely at that middle or liminal period, we slow it down, we think of it very carefully, we try to understand what the full experience, when I talked about holistic, what's going on in the house, what's going on in the room, what's going on in the life of the person. And through all of that, we can arrive, for example, in this case, and again, this doesn't even have to involve ethnography. This is just bringing some theory in, thinking about that transformative experience and how the brand of cereal can participate in that transformation. So it can turn your sort of humdrum morning into something that is joyful because of the senses that you're having with the cereal, of the lift that you get from that experience, and you attach the brand to that. So if you put all of that together, it isn't as if you have a commercial that talks about ritual and liminality, but under the hood, if you will, for the anthropologist is the theory that gives some structure and maybe drives some insight that would be greater than just watching people have breakfast. So you do need, it does help to have some training or hire an anthropologist with some training if you want to get to that kind of level. And there are lots of examples of bringing theory in. And I can tell you that in some meetings, I would mention theory, and in some meetings, it would be there, but I wouldn't really talk about it because, you know, it was too much. The client really didn't want to hear it. Mm-hmm. So it really depended. So they're in a way, they're different things. Think of one as a method, and the other one is a theory that is then being applied to the method.
Bob, how do you, again, I'm just thinking about the world in which I've worked in and lived, and I'm sure people listening are too.
Yeah.
In a way, I hope we all are a little bit of that. So when we're working with brands, we're watching people shop and we're talking to people who are eating and all the rest of it. But at what point do you kind of disseminate that and drive, you know, without going too much into your theory, but drive a kind of insight that can be tested and it's not just a belief, if you know what I mean? Because there's kind of a, it's in this situation and that's it.
Yeah, I think that, that's the difference, in a sense, between anthropology and applied anthropology.
Thought it was.
Yeah. if all we're doing is coming up with a lot of cool stuff, and we don't help either our client or our colleague figure out how to use it, you know, we're not going to get hired again. In my case, I was, among other things, I wrote strategies, advertising strategies. Or I would help with the client's marketing strategy. So what you need to do, what the anthropologist needs to do, it's really the same thing that it is a good market researcher. A good market researcher is really a consultant. You know, the person doesn't just go and do the research and hand it over. And they don't just have the findings, they have recommendations. And so a business anthropologist would go to the same place. A business anthropologist would gather all this information and then wouldn't just hand it over, would say, oh, well, here's some thoughts about what you can do with it strategically. In my case, given the kind of jobs that I had, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, I would then write the strategy that would be used by, say, a creative team to develop advertising. So I would be basically transposing these findings from market research that was anthropological into what we would call a creative brief or a copy strategy or something along those lines. If you're talking about product development, it would be the same thing. The market researcher or the anthropologist would help work, I would hope, more towards strategy than just stopping and saying, here's the report, you know, we'll see you next time. But you're absolutely right. And, you know, you're thinking the way a marketer thinks and the way all my clients thought, which is, so you got to help me figure out what to do with this.
Yeah. And kind of on that note then, Bob, I mean, you talked about Procter & Gamble's Febreze brand and their work, you know, there. But are there examples, you know, whether they're a non-client of yours, but are there examples of brands who just missed the boat in terms of understanding the culture or understanding, you know, that they clearly didn't engage in, you know, anthropology or ethnography before they did something big?
Well, there are a number of examples historically of companies. I remember, and I don't remember the execution. It might have been for Coke, but it could have been for Pepsi, where one of the Kardashians, I don't remember which one, maybe you know, she thought she could, you know, save the world with a Coke. That was a cultural misstep, not understanding who they were talking to and what they were doing. That, and they knew it right away. Those kinds of things happen. I think companies, you know, if they go abroad and they, for example, if you were to go to China and try to market in the way that I was talking about, if you were trying to market from the floor up, you'd fall flat on your face. You wouldn't be able to, you would get nowhere. So there are many missteps that companies make. There are many things that they do right. You know, the great J&J example of Tylenol many years ago when they had that awful problem and then they corrected it. You know, in a sense, I think there was something going on that was cultural because the company understood that in our society back then, and it's true now, the best response when you have a disaster is to come clean right away. Now, you know, a lot of our politicians in Washington don't quite get that. And a lot of corporate executives don't get it still, but most of them, I think, seem to, you know, especially in an era of cancel culture, you know, you have to watch out for those things. But I think in general, and you were speaking of culture change, I think that the patience for cultural missteps is thinner than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and so on. And that's a real test of it. And that's one way you know the culture has changed, because things happen so quickly.
And you just mentioned, you know, a buzzword, the hot word of, you know, cancel culture. What does that really mean? And does it really exist?
Well, I think it in a sense it exists, in that we've decided, you know, or there are pundits or there are newscasters, whoever it is, have decided it's a thing. I think that, you know, for many years, we could go back decades, where if people did something that was unacceptable culturally, they would get in trouble. You know, Alexander Hamilton got into big trouble because of an affair that he had, and that was 220 years ago. And the culture judged that harshly. And whether or not you could argue that he was canceled, you know, unfortunately, he didn't have a very long career after all of that. But, you know, the whole idea of, if you make a cultural misstep, people have always judged you, not just in the United States. Of course, different cultures have different rules. And so, you know, how you get canceled in one culture is not the same way as you might in another culture. So cancel it's an interesting word, in that what's happened to it is that it's gained greater currency as being this thing that happens, you know, just like that. You know, you say something wrong, you do something wrong, you're fired, or you'll never get a gig again. And so I certainly think that that is accelerated, and the light is a lot harsher. There seems to be less room for forgiveness. On the other hand, you know, working sort of in another current is something like the Me Too movement, which gained, you know, you talk about culture change. That was a major movement that that didn't exist years ago. I mean, of course, the horrific acts were committed, but women didn't talk about it. And then they started to talk about it. And then we got into this a period where we were moving into this place where you have to listen to the women, you have to listen to what they say, and you have to believe them. But of course, there's an opportunity for the person who might be accused to respond. It's not only women, by the way, it could be a man who's in a similar situation. So all of these things are happening. I don't know that, I think they've happened for a long, long time. Maybe Neanderthals had cancel culture. I'm not sure.
And just coming back again, a couple of the questions we've asked seem generic, but I'm keenly interested as well in this play on what's unique and different, because you talked for example on a marketing, and I'm keenly interested on what and how this product design piece has come to the fore. And what does that mean? Is that a different way of looking at anthropology? Is it because the world has changed? Is it because product designers are developing it more intrinsically based on evidence? You know, what's the drivers for it becoming a topical?
You mean the anthropology side of it?
Yeah.
Well, actually, what happened a number of years ago, and it really got started at the Stanford D School, and then evolved into IDEO, which has offices all over. Design thinking is really the what we're talking about in this particular case. I mean, design is bigger than design thinking, but the area that I'm focusing on in this, when we're talking sort of in the realm of marketing, is design thinking. But it's not only in marketing; it could be designing an organization, designing floor space, and it could be designing really anything. But design thinking early on was very interested in a couple of things. One of them was actually talking to human beings. So human-centered design, focusing on people. So starting, you know, it's interesting for those of us in marketing, and that includes the three of us and maybe some people that attend to this this kind of discussion. We've always started with the people. It seems to me, I'm always fascinated when I read an article that's published by someone, you know, from the marketing world that says, you know what we need to do? We need to first listen to the customer, you know, and you want to say, well, wait a minute, people have been doing that for decades in marketing and in many other areas as well. So designers seem to like that idea. And they said, we have to talk to human beings and we have to make our designs more about what humans need, whether they know it or not. And so that was one part of it. Another part of it is the concept of empathy, which is really in the wind. You know, you talk about, we talked about cancel culture. Well, another side of what's happening in terms of a cultural current is this rise of empathy, at least a discussion of it. And so a part of it was the fact, I think it really started to take off probably around the time that Trump was elected because people felt that he lacked empathy. And some people feel that Joe Biden's strength in winning was that he exhibited empathy or to a large degree. But it's been around as a concern for people in design for much longer than that. And they, when they talk about empathy, what they mean is, again, going back to the human being and the whole process, understanding what they're thinking and feeling from their point of view, not from yours, which is a critical part of what anthropologists do too. We always try to understand what the subject or respondent or native's point of view is rather than our own, so we can see how they see the world. Well, that's used in design and by good marketers. And then along the way with all of that, the kind of the third piece of this is doing ethnography. And they talk a lot about ethnography. They talk about ethnography more than anthropology. And what they mean by ethnography is they often conflate it with just doing interviews. But what we're really talking about is in use on site interviews, you know, doing them the way I've been describing them, where people work, play, shop, et cetera. Designers really get a better understanding of how a designer fits into people's lives and they start developing empathy. And of course, then it's all human centered if they can use something like ethnography as a tool. So that's where the value has been manifested of the kind of anthropology that we're talking about, specifically the methodological side.
If you were to kind of package this and, you know, you're talking to someone who's earlier in their career or they're thinking about starting a business or they're just thinking about making their way in the world.
Right.
What can they take away from the value of, you know, of anthropology or the lessons of anthropology that should teach us? How should regular people think about this?
Well, I think it's very much along the lines that I've been talking about in that it adds another dimension. So you can think of it as a dimension in terms of depth, thickening, gaining a deeper understanding of why your customers behave the way they do. So that's a conceptual starting point. And so if you're starting out or if you're in early or mid-career and you're thinking about better understanding your customers, I know it's tempting to either go to big data, you know, do text mining. You can learn a lot from text mining and you can do sentiment analysis and you can learn a lot about people. Mm-hmm. But nothing beats looking at their faces, looking into their eyes, getting a sense of their heartbeat quickening when you talk to them about a product idea. And not just asking questions and not just mining data, but discovering through a kind of iterative process, asking questions slightly different ways, asking people to expand, tell me more, help me understand, allowing time in an interview rather than to just ask question after question and just write down the answer and move on, slowing it down so you have an opportunity to create really more of an illuminating piece of research than you might have had before. And I would say all marketers should do that to some degree, whether they hire an anthropologist to do it, a good market research person, someone with another, you know, people with other kinds of social science degrees can make contributions. I would say that a perspective from the humanities is a really great perspective to have. You know, if any of your children ever say, you know, they don't want to major in business, they want to major in anthropology or in English, I would say encourage them. Because not only could they go into business anthropology, but the lessons from English or philosophy can serve them really well in business. And I'm not the only person who makes this argument. There are books written on it and people that talk about it a lot, but I think it's a really valuable perspective. I would say that we're so fascinated now by STEM that sometimes we forget that the arts and the humanities all have a lot to contribute. So I would say, I would remind people that are early mid-career that they've got to, as I said, take more of a 360 view of their customers and then bring in more to their toolkit because then they'll have, I think, much better insights. I've seen it time and again, and also uncommon insights. You know, the idea, if you're doing the same thing everybody else is doing, you're just going to wind up in the same place. You don't want to do that. So you should do something different. And I think the kind of anthropological sensibility is a good place, good way to get there.
We sit in an era, Bob, where, you know, so much has changed. There's been so much conflict. There's been so much chaos, really, over the past year with COVID and prior to that,
right, you
know, that with politics. And sometimes it's hard to kind of know who's pushing and who's pulling, but
right,
it's been particularly interesting because in some ways over the past year or two, companies have stepped into a role that had often been borne by government and, you know, where government was hesitant. But what I wanted to ask about is, do you feel that business and politics reflect culture or influence it?
Well, you know, the answer to that question is yes, because they do both. You know, we have to, any business that is not mindful of culture change isn't going to do very well. I mean, I'm not just talking about obvious ones like the fashion industry or the food industry that need to follow trends, but they also generate trends because they will develop new products that the consumer may not have thought they needed. And then the consumer says, this can change my life, like an iPhone. I would never have thought I needed an iPhone. And Steve Jobs would say that. He would say, in fact, why do market research? Consumers can't tell you what they want. And in a way, he's right. Many times they can't. They can tell you, but they can't always tell you what the really game-changing idea is. So certainly, you know, whether it was the old cell phones, whether it was personal computers, they changed culture. Zoom has changed. Zoom is a response to a pandemic, which has led to a different way of interacting that we did a little bit, but we didn't do nearly as much. That now companies have said, well, you know, there are some things that we want to retain. So it's one thing to say, you know, I wouldn't say that yes, the culture has changed as a result of the pandemic for sure, short term, but whether or not there's been a sustained change, I think most people would say, yes, organizations will change because you probably will have an option, at least at many companies, to work part of the time from home. We realize that, yes, it's important to be in the office for sure, because, you know, it's hard to get promoted if your boss doesn't see you on the job sometimes. You need to learn the rules for how you interact with people. You need to be a good collaborator face-to-face as well as online. All of that stuff is really valuable. But from an organizational perspective, I think a lot of organizations have said, you know, we can also, people can be more productive if their time is asynchronous. I know I can. I know a lot of people say they can. You know, you get really busy at 10 at night because that's when your most productive time is. That's fine. And so there's that. And there's also this whole idea that you can even have some better experiences using, for example, Zoom. One of the things I found in teaching, and colleagues of mine have found this too, is that, you know, it's one thing to have office hours with students, but it's really great also to be able to Zoom with students and have, you know, sort of the one-on-one or the group with the professor having conversations that can kind of go on a little longer uninterrupted through a Zoom. And maybe at a time that, you know, you wouldn't normally do it. And organizations are finding that out too. So, you know, I see that as an example of, you know, the business is influencing our culture at large because it changes the way we interact with one another. And then obviously the other way around too.
Fascinating. So as you look at this, you know, what do you think, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now, anthropologists will say about this era in human history?
You know, we're much better at looking back than looking around than we are at looking ahead. It's really hard to say. I think the one thing, I can't tell you for sure what we'll conclude, but I think when I talked about that middle liminality period, you know, that period of change, the way I would think about it is that we're just getting to the end of this liminal period, this middle period. And so I would say that you know, we were, I wouldn't say it was stasis, but, you know, we were living our lives, we did whatever we did, and we were separated from that by the pandemic. And now we're living in that transitional period that's transformed all of us in one way or another. And we will re-enter our lives, but we will be changed. And that's what happens. And so I think that the important thing here for all of us is to obviously be aware of that, but you know how we can, in a sense, maximize the positives and minimize the negatives. One of the ways I think about this too is there's a theory in evolution called punctuated equilibrium, which I love as an idea. I always thought I should name a rock band after that. If I ever have a rock band, that's what I'll call it. But punctuated equilibrium is exactly what it sounds like. It's not a proven way that evolution works, but it's an observed way that evolution maybe works, at least some evolution. And I think that's what we're in now. Our equilibrium, again, not complete. There's always change going on to the point we were talking about before, but the relative equilibrium before the pandemic hit and punctuated our lives has shook up everything. So it's not as if we're dinosaurs, although I think there are some institutions and some ways of interacting that were dinosaurs. You know, these giant sales meetings where you send thousands of people to get together for 2 days and, you know, drink and maybe go to a couple of sessions and seminars and all. They're fun and they have value, but they're enormously expensive and time consuming. And a lot of people don't even like them and don't get much out of them. So there'll probably still be some of those, but maybe on a smaller scale. So companies will reinvent the way they do business. The way that friends interact. I've developed some closer friendships with some friends I've known for over 30 years because we have a Saturday Zoom. That's culture change. It's also small group change, but then that affects the culture at large. So I think anthropologists will see this as we look back as a period of a global period. And again, it's not the same everywhere in the world, a global period of, let's say, 18 months, maybe 2 years. I don't know, who knows how long it's going to really last, where we will have been transformed by the pandemic, and to look at those areas where, you know, those liminal periods allow for our senses to be more acute. They allow us to experiment and reinvent. All of those things happen, and they're all happening now. And so we'll look at that. I think that's the kind of analytical framework anthropologists will take. I don't know that it will bring any major fresh insights, but it might, because we might think about new mythologies that have arisen. We might think of new rules for engagement. I've talked about those with regard to Zoom, but there are many others. You know, will people be hugging and kissing and shaking hands? I don't know. So it's along those lines, I think.
I actually read an article, Bob, and I was going to ask you about this a little while ago, talking about, you know, when there was the plague and various other global events, and people didn't shake hands and weren't allowed to, and quite quickly after that they started to. And I was kind of sensing what you were saying there, and I compartmentalize it in some ways, as it's, you know, all the things you said may come to fruition, but it's kind of an irritant, for want of a better expression. Yeah. And it's in the way. And I'm sure, I don't know which part of the brain, the amygdala or all the other chemicals that's going on in your brain of awareness, you know, it's making a lot of people fatigued. So the question I guess I'd ask you is, you think of human behavior, which is anthropology, what about the humans? So you talked a lot then about the environment and businesses and things, but what about humans? How from your learnings and experience, how you know, how quickly do they adapt, adopt, and move back to type, etc., etc.? I'm intrigued by that.
You know, you're talking about something that I think has a lot of validity, in that there is a kind of continuity and a kind of consistency to who we are as human beings, the way we deal with struggle, what we want to retain, that we need small social groups, we need to touch each other, we need to be in contact, which is why I don't think that offices will just say, you know, we don't need to be there, or that companies will say, we don't need those gatherings at all. We'll probably do them in different ways. And so I think that the vast majority of the kind of behavior that we engaged in before the pandemic will come back eventually. I think it'll come back in stages. I don't think that we're going to really stop shaking hands. We're going to stop shaking hands now. I think we're going to get back to it. I think we're going to get back to a lot of things. For a while, you know, we'll be doing fist bumps and we'll be, you know, whatever we'll be doing. But I think that we need those things. I think it's, you know, and if you go back through history, obviously, you know, culture has changed in many, many ways. But there are some fundamentals about our need to affiliate with other people outside or very close in kinship group or close in friendship group. We need to have those extended relationships, and they're good for us, whether they are about commerce or whether they're about just avoiding warfare. We need to get to know other people deeply, and the kind of interaction that we can have face to face, and you know, get drunk together sometimes, whatever it was we might be doing, or play a game or whatever it is. Face to face, those things are. I'm an aggressive optimist. So whatever I may say as an anthropologist is also colored by that. You know, we all have our bias. And I think I'm with you, Simon, and I suspect Mike too, that we'll be, that a lot of what we will be doing in terms of interaction will change. There are obviously some changes, other cultural trends that have thought away the way we think about what we'll call the other, that don't have specifically to do with the pandemic, but have to do with things that have always happened in the United States and throughout the entire world, that have more stickiness to them. You know, it's like what Martin Luther King said about, you know, the arc of justice. You know, you'd like to think that things are just getting better. And so there are changes that do seem to move us forward. And those are cultural changes and human changes.
Yeah, fascinating.
So Bob, you know, kind of just thinking about this and thinking about it more broadly, as an anthropologist, what do you hope humanity will take away from what's happened? You know, you talked about being an aggressive optimist. What do you hope people take away?
You know, I think what a lot of people will do, I don't know this, if this is true of everyone, but I think a lot of people will, having lost something, you know, you don't know what you've lost until it's gone, whatever Joni Mitchell said. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to get a lot of it back. And as we get it back, I think we're going to savor it more. We're going to appreciate it more. You know, I know the first time that I can go out to dinner and eat inside, boy, am I going to love that. And I have a feeling that I'm going to love it more than just that once. I think I'm going to think to myself, you know, this is a privilege. This is a great thing. It's a privilege, you know, when my poker group can play a game of poker face to face, when I can get together and I play rock music with friends, when I can do that, I'm going to savor it. And again, I don't think I'm going to forget about that for a long time. Maybe eventually I will, you know, but the truth is, I think it has changed us in that way. Of course, we're going to be, you know, maybe more mindful about our health, and, you know, for people who've gained weight, they'll have to lose weight. There'll be certain things, but in terms of, maybe how this all may have changed us, there have been some real tragedies, and we can't forget those. I remember reading a column by David Brooks, who writes for the New York Times, and he was saying that the pandemic, the global pandemic of 100 years ago, 1918, that period, that people didn't talk about it. Because they were ashamed that his argument is that they were ashamed that they didn't come to the enough aid of people in their social network. I think there are probably other reasons as well. But I think people will talk about this for a very, very long time. I think our cultural memory, global cultural memory, will keep this as an event. You know, we talk a lot about 9/11 as being a watershed event in the United States. Of course, this is even larger than that because it's global. And I think that this will be in our collective cultural memory for many years to come. And I think, I'd like to think that we're going to learn from it and make the most of the experiences that we maybe took for granted.
Fantastic. Well, Bob, thanks so much. I mean, I think about this conversation, and there's so much that people can take away in terms of, you know, kind of the power of observation and the need to really dig in and, you know, take that deeper dive that you talked about that's related to anthropology and understand, you know, the customer, understand the, you know, the environment, understand the culture. And there's so many factors and so many ways that that, you know, affects us all. And then being aware of how things change and the influences that cause it. So I really, really appreciate your time here and the insights that you've shared.
Well, I've been happy to do it. You've asked some great questions.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. It's fantastic. And I was talking to Mike about before we were going to chat with you, and it's so powerful, you know, the qualitative and anthropological world that I don't feel, you know, and I've had the luxury and fortune to work with you before, that people, you know, are so embroiled in quantitative stuff. And it's so important that you have to get that paintbrush and like you call it, get the thick stuff down as well. And it's so, so important. So thank you for sharing that.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast. And thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.